Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Tattoos, which are as diverse as the individuals who wear them, have been around for eons. One of the oldest was discovered in the Italian Alps on a 5,300-year-old mummy. Tattoos have served as amulets, status symbols, signs of love and religious beliefs, adornments, and even forms of punishment. Today, 3D tattoos, watercolor tattoos, even those that glow in the dark, have helped the industry generate more than $2 billion a year in revenue. It's estimated one in five adults in the United States has at least one tattoo. One of the body artists responsible for that statistic is my guest today. Friday Jones opened her own couture tattoo studio on Manhattan's Fifth Avenue in 2009. She also has a studio in Porto, Montenegro. A classically trained artist, Friday's work has appeared on living and still canvases. She's won top awards for drawing, and her work is included in some of the world's most prestigious collections. Her introduction to tattoo art began with her apprenticeship at Inksmith & Rogers Studios, which she completed while attending Jacksonville University, where she earned degrees in art, philosophy, and religion. It was Friday who gave Angelina Jolie her original Billy Bob Thornton tattoo, and her impressive client list today includes Oscar and Grammy winners, as well as heads of state. Her art has graced the covers of hit albums and Fender Jackson guitars. Friday, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sandy. It's great to be here.
First of all, where'd the name Friday come from?
Friday came from the dark days of New York City tattooing, where we were an outlaw industry. Tattooing was outlawed from 1963 to 1997 in New York. So any of us coming in had our handles, had our tags. And I got mine from the preeminent master craftsman, Spider Webb, who held it down here for about three decades. And yeah, it's a little bit of a long story, but that's how it was Gal Friday, and then that evolved into Friday Jones.
So when you were first involved in the art of tattooing, you were committing a crime.
I was actually apprenticing in Florida, which was quite legal and quite above board. And it was my apprenticeship was under some serious masters. We were blending our own pigments, making our own needles, creating our own machines. And so, and it was all very, you know, in the light of day and a lot of information exchanged. However, one of the few states, in addition to, and it wasn't even a state, New York was legal, but the city itself was outlawed, along with Oklahoma and South Carolina.
I mean, that's crazy.
There was some backlash around the beatnik generation, you know, when the baby boomers were young and starting to feel their oats.
That's my generation.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you guys started this, I say.
You're welcome.
Mainstream. I'm with you. Yes, absolutely.
But I can't imagine that when you were growing up and thinking about applying to college, whatever, that in the back of your mind, you were going to become a body artist.
I absolutely was not. I didn't even like tattoos. My mother is a fashion model. My father is a Pentagon fighter pilot, you know, kind of character. And we were very serious middle class people. And I was on the wife trajectory.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up all over being a Navy brass.
Oh, sure.
So a lot of West Coast, a lot of Texas, a lot of the Southeast, you know, places that weren't, and always rural areas where, you know, you could make a lot of noise with jet planes. So not the kind of places where conducive to a lot of creative thinking and creative expression. It was, you know, it was very kind of countryside.
So you're kind of a bit of a rebel?
I don't know, Sandy, if I call a bit of a rebel. I think I was just, I had already, by the time I got into tattooing, I had already worked in an art room, and I had made a living as a commercial artist, and it's actually for the U.S. Postal Service, doing a bunch of eagles. And I knew I had to work. I'd already been married. I knew I needed to hit the bricks with a career. And I just didn't want to work with such a big group of people controlling the creative process. I wanted to work more mano a mano with an individual.
But did you ever entertain the idea that maybe you would work alone in a studio, that you would be a painter?
I never had the huevos for that. My mother was a painter and never did anything with it. Amazing, talented artist, always used her beauty and her ways with men. And honestly, it was just never encouraged in my very macho family to really
pursue
we were always
that creativity.
We were in supportive roles. And I guess I did buck against that eventually, but I feel like it was more following my own path as I became an adult rather than going against anything. It was just, I was lucky to get a brilliant apprenticeship with one of the top shops on the planet. And they're a franchise, by the way, five studios. Do they do very, very well? I couldn't say the numbers, but extremely well.
Do people just, maybe today that's the case, that I'm going to be a body artist? Did that ever enter your mind?
Heck no. When my sister, I was 19, and my 18-year-old sister got a tiny little tattoo because she's in the army of her husband's name. I cried and wailed.
How could you do that?
How are you going to marry the lawyer? The doctors aren't going to have to touch you now. Like, what is she going to do with her life?
Uh-huh.
And that really was 88 in the mindset for, you know, middle-class women.
Right, sure.
And then, you know. So
you go to Jacksonville University where you take philosophy. Religion.
Actually, yes. I had to drive 3,000 miles across country from San Francisco. And the whole time, and I was going in for medical illustration, which is Jacksonville's a great, they have those great private school with small programs, and I could create a program that I thought, basically, I was getting to this unemployable state. You know, I was a classically trained artist, and I watched my mother kind of screw off her creative
blow
career.
It off, kind of.
So I was really on a mission to make a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that, man, I just didn't want to have a bunch of suits telling me, you know, meetings and how this is and really pare down the work. So it was really about working with an individual and how could I do that? And I'm driving by these Navy bases and there are these tattoo shops and I'm like, you know, I think I could do that. And it was just a kid, 21, kind of desperately moving into college because that's what was done. And I didn't want to waste all my money and scholarships on this degree without having an end game.
A goal.
A plan. And then so the first day I got into Jacksonville, I put all my Eagles from the post office in my portfolio and put on this professional dress and did my hair and makeup and walked into the studio like a corporate gig.
In a tattoo studio?
Mm-hmm. Dressed like because I was ignorant.
Ink Smith & Rogers was the penultimate.
It is a massive, very prestigious fleet of studios. 22 men working there now. And Eric King
men?
Smith, yes, all men. It's an all men. It's very, very, my career from childhood to here has been very patriarchal.
Uh-huh.
You know, like most of us, I say.
Uh-huh.
And not one woman today. But but I'm still in with those guys, you know, and yeah.
So you're an anomaly, huh?
Yeah, at least with them. I mean,
what about that woman that was on the TLC show, Kat?
Kat
that
was West Coast. She was, she's came from a Latin culture, and they were kind of maybe not so, especially she's immigrant, and I think they may be more flexible. Like, she came in as a young girl, and she was, her boyfriends were all tattooed, and it was kind of more, she had more of a street life,
okay.
Say, at an early age. And there's a big culture for first-generation Mexican, you know, where they're like,
so it's almost a natural progression for her.
Yeah, it was more for her culture and not so much for mine.
So how did you get into Ink Smith & Rogers being female?
Well, it was at the time, his wife was tattooing, Eric Ink Smith's wife. So the two of them had this team. So there was a precedent there at the time. And I walked in and everything was great. Eric's like, look at these Eagles. These are fantastic. All right. Okay. Like, go in and say hi to his wife. And can I tell you, she took the biggest harpy steel dump on my head at the time. I mean, now in retrospect, I'm like,
well, what, explain that? What do you mean?
She was, you know, her oh man, I got all this like glory for the hard work that I had done as an illustrator at the time. And then I'm just naive. I will go in to show this other artist that I wanted to admire and wanted to emulate my work. And she just saw me as a threat, as, you know, the young girl coming up, where she was kind of the queen bee, and that dogged me my whole apprenticeship.
But you were still, quote, let in.
Yeah, because I think Eric was wise. He put me with one of his satellite shops, and so I got mentoring in a safe space. But yeah, she was gunning for me the whole 5 years that I got the degree. She was
so much for sisterhood
too, by the way. You know, the boy apprentices. So that's why. That's, you know, and I learned a big life lesson from that. And it kind of also showed me that I got to be really women forward in my career as well. It was just playing the boys game wasn't going to help. And
you didn't really think that that's what was going to be part of your career, that you're going to be leading a charge, so to speak.
I'll tell you what, early on, I did. I knew, because I'm a sorority girl. I was a professional cheerleader. I was in college, university cheerleader. So I'm very, that woman, whatever we had as athletics at the time, that was cheerleading. So I was always active in our narrow roles as women, mm-hmm. and aggressive. You know, my family's fighter pilots, and I was not allowed to be a fighter pilot. And I really, really wanted to be a fighter pilot.
So you were going to get what you needed to get with grit and determination and balls.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Friday Jones, body artist who has a salon in New York City and in Porto, Montenegro. We're going to get to that in just a second. So you get your training, you see that you've got talent, you're creative, you're allowed to express yourself in maybe ways that other tattoo artists haven't. And then what happens after the apprenticeship?
Well, I got my blessing from the master, from Mr. Inksmith, and I hit the road. I went to surf. I did my surfing life for about 18 months, and because I had all of a sudden had this in-pocket trade. Now, mind you, back in the day, we're doing crosses and stars and Tasmanian devils. Like, it's not this artistic movement. It's a service, which, frankly, was great in my development as well, like learning to serve people rather than put my ooh on them.
Got it.
Okay. So I surfed, and then I ended up in L.A. and started working in Hollywood. I thought tattooing was cool, but now I'm graduate college. I need to get a real job, quote unquote.
Yep.
And again, there was not this big, broad movement. It was very underground at the time. And I didn't see a place for myself in shops generally, which were mostly boys, you know. And I love working with guys. I love my guys. But, man, sometimes day after day, it's just, it'll wear you down.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd go into film, and I thought I'd be a production artist. And I had some success at that. And then I went and I learned HTML. I did .com. And then in the late 90s, when it was blowing up, I made a lot of money really fast. And I saw the potential for what a career can do for, you know, for an artist. But again, like the .com is a bunch of swinging. I might as well go back to an industry where at least I have a lot of flexibility. I can pick and choose my clients.
You can be your own boss.
And it's cash. Let's talk about it.
So you just bagged all of that and decided to open up your own place?
I kept it pretty low key for a lot of years. I would work for a lot for my friends, woman-owned shops that I thought I could get along. I lived in cities that I loved, New Orleans and Seattle and Baltimore and D.C.
So nothing kind of non-pluses you. You just charge ahead and do whatever the hell you want to do.
Well, it helps being a Navy brat because you're really flexible and you don't have an idea of home, I think, in a standard sense. So my dad would always say, you got to bloom where you're planted. I wanted to be a great artist. And that was my only, I didn't care about making a lot of money. I didn't care about running a big shop with a bunch of staff. I just wanted to be a great, great artist. And that took the discipline. I had to have my time to go to the museums and draw. I had to have my time to go to classes and draw and paint and work for masters and absorb everything I could on that.
But what
path.
Does that mean, be a great artist in your head? And I'm going to take that literally. Does that mean being a great artist on someone's body?
I'm just going to say it in the broadest sense. Like, I wanted to be able to draw anything, the drop of a dime. And that was from Hollywood because those guys are so skilled. And that is just discipline, putting what my instructors would call pencil mileage, like just doing the due diligence of drawing, draftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of being a great artist is understanding the human condition. And I was reading, you know, I worked with a lot of masters and I'd read a lot of biographies. And you got to be able to have a voice. I think it's got to be more than just replicating a beautiful image. It's got to find a way to speak to the soul.
So you travel around, you work for other places, and then you wind up in Manhattan.
Right.
Was that your first foray?
No way. Well, I would come up to Manhattan on spring breaks from Florida from school and work for Spider, work for the underground master here in New York. And New York was such an exciting place to work while it was outlawed because they had no information. So it was like really, you're watching guys who were tattooing the way their masters did in the 50s. And by the 80s, the tattooing, the technique, and it had been expanded so rapidly. Mm-hmm. There was a lot more information. So you go to New York and you're like, you know, Tony Polito's tattooing out of his kitchen and his, you know, as much as making Managani, you know. It's like this thing.
Uh-huh.
And my Inksmith & Rogers is a very structured environment, wonderfully so, because
while you're learning too.
Yes. And, you know, the craftsmanship part. But this other part, Spider was this avant-garde famous artist of the Lower East Side. They called themselves the availabilists, you know, working with whatever they could. And Annie Sprinkle was up in that circle. And Les Barney, who's H.R. Giger's manager. So there's this, the baby boomers of that outlawed time were just these radicals. And that having the spring break, I could only dip my toe in it for like maybe 10 days.
But it really titillated you and it whet your appetite.
Oh, yeah. I was titillating them. So I guess that's why they let me around. But yeah, you know, I had to go back to my nice grounded, you know, being Smith & Rogers and college and just be normal.
But you knew that you could always come back, that you could go home again.
And the expression offered by New York, just the number of sheer number of personalities. Mm-hmm. You could really push the envelopes here.
Sure.
And I didn't feel there wasn't that everywhere else.
So you go back, you finish school, and then your trajectory.
Okay, so when I came to New York, by the time I was ready for New York, it was 2004.
Okay.
And I was 34, and I was looking down the barrel of 40, and I knew that I had to maybe stay grounded and start building up a client base and start really like... And publishing, frankly, putting my work out there. And, I was like, all this women's socialization, but I was really reluctant to,
Well, it's unnerving and overwhelming.
Well, you know, the guys could do it so easily. And I was always so frustrated that I was like, well, and then like, listen to this guy, like, going, oh, that's a badass tattoo right there. You know, talking about his own work. I'm like, ew, I can't imagine, you know. I'm just so like, ew, I can't imagine myself saying such an, aggressive thing. And now... You
out of
know,
my
honestly,
way.
Now
out of
I understand
my way.
The philosophy of it. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot to learn from men mm-hmm. in that regard.
But it's also that importance of believing in yourself.
Yeah. And honestly, even if you don't, you got to say the words and the client will generally go along with it.
You come to New York and you start to feel your way. And it's a little unnerving, but you've got, like I said, grit and determination, right?
Well, it was funny because by 2004, I'm like cocky. You know, I tattooed Angie all over. I'm like this hot artist. And
can we go to her? I mean, you just...
Sure. Angie's a genius, first of all, I'll say. And she was totally, when I was running around with her, she was this like punk rock artist, pure artist from a family of artists. And, you know, we're all kind of freaky in that sense. And she was just like a live wire. She had just she was doing Gone 60 Seconds, so she had all these little fake tattoos from the movie. Mm-hmm. And I was living with her best friend. We were up in the Hollywood Hills, and we had this house, and it was gorgeous. And so Angie would come after the set every night. That was her little like break from work. And one night, you know, she would be saying like, "Oh, I'm jonesing for a tattoo," and I was like, "Oh, of course, darling." And she wasn't Angie yet; she was, she was this ingenue, and but definitely her star was rising. And she was a dramatic personality too, on top of it. So really exciting to be around. So she's like, "Oh yeah, whatever tattoo you'd want, darling." And then all of a sudden she's like, and she's having, you know, she was like, Billy Bob was sniffing around at the time. And none of us supported that. But you've got to support your friends until they pull the trigger on it. And then you can take a dump on them, right? Or whatever.
Right.
But so at the time, she's like, oh, I want Billy Bob's name. And Angie was already tattooed. And with like, she was tattooed, you know, with aggressive tattoos. Like, it wasn't no little tiny bits. She was a warrior in that sense.
No roses on her shoulder.
Yeah, she's like, you know, pretty thorny tribal and some like Latin, like bold Latin statements. And she was really fearless. And she was in a culture that was, she was dating girls and it was like kind of aggressive lesbian culture. And so that was all wonderful. And so I'm conflicted as her artist and is to like, well, I think this guy is kind of a dink and I don't think the relationship's going anywhere. But we had this law at Inksmith where, you know, if they, after 2 weeks, the client still wants it, then who are we
shut
to judge?
Shut up and do it.
You know, shut up and do it. And so after 2 weeks, she was still into it. So I was like, all right, you know, well, I'm with you, babe. So we made this little late night photo shoot. We all slumber party like girls and, you know, we did a little bondage, 50 Shades of Grey thing for the tattoo experience, you know, the needles hurt or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was just us being artists and creative and stuff. And I watered down the ink and I let her know. I'm like, I'm going to water this ink down so it's easy to remove.
Wow.
And lasering was just kind of becoming a thing then too. So there was just this like all of a sudden open door of freedom where, wow, I could do this really extreme radical thing, which is back then it was really more extreme and radical than it was now. And then, you know, and then not have to deal with the consequences too much. So they weren't in public together at the time. I did this little tiny cute tattoo, you know, in a place where she could hide it when, you know, she needed to. And when she won her Oscar, he dumped Laura and he went with her. And then, you know, she got it bigger from another artist. I wasn't around at the time. Mm-hmm, but that experience with Angelina was wonderful. And she was always very generous. She took me to all her parties. I was grateful
story.
To be a bestie
great
for a while.
Great story.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Friday Jones, body artist who has a salon in New York City and in Porto, Montenegro. Okay, so now you're in New York and take us.
Okay, so 2004, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be 40. I need to figure this out.
Right.
I need to like make a stand. So I Spider had just lost one of his managers. She had moved on. And there he is. He's this old guy. He's like late 60s now. And he had the space on 7th Avenue and 17th. And Chelsea was changing. Like, oh, you know, it's not, you know, our little punk rock oil drums and,
sure,
you know,
definitely evolving
New York stuff. So all of a sudden there's William Sonoma and there's all this, you know, all these things are
all gentrifying.
Like, yeah. Who knows? Who knew? But I had been working Silicon Valley and Hollywood. So I'd had this experience with these upper level, you know, moneyed kind of personalities. And I told Spider, I was like, hey, look, let's change the business model. You know, let's try to do something more service driven rather than, you know, like a tough guy tattoo shop my way, the highway, sit in the chair, shut up, kind of, you know. So, and it worked pretty cool for a while. It was, I was able to build a client base. You know, Spider was on his way out to retirement. So we didn't, you know, I needed to expand. And I had a gay best friend across the street who is in the salon, Victor Ortega, very talented, now heavily tattooed stylist, and he works here in Miami. But he eventually went to a salon over on Fifth Avenue, and he said, you know, you should come and check the space out. It's 4,000 square foot. It's gorgeous. And I'd already known from my client base, like Angie and these others, that, man, I just can't bring some people into a bullpen situation with a bunch of guys talking about, like, the bitches that, you know, it can be really horrible.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't have any structures in place generally in our industry, and it's only, you know, what money comes through the door is what will dictate, you know,
got it,
you know, the grace of my coworkers and my peers. Yeah, so I thought, wow, the amenities, you know, a little glass of Chardonnay, a private place to talk about, you know, life's deeper meanings. And that was really it, and concierge. And so
you made the move?
I made the move. I ended up tattooing the owners, and the gay culture was hugely marginalized, of course, for centuries. And so they were way more flexible and creative in their approaches. So they were really open to the idea, and it just took off. I mean, I've been 6 years at this location now. So
is it strictly a tattoo salon?
No, it's a full service salon spa. So
I can get my hair cut.
You got all the hair in the front, and it looks over Fifth Avenue. You see the American flag waving. It's well lit, gorgeous, flowers everywhere.
And how many body artists work?
There's two of us, me and Tim Acupunks.
Is that
Tim Acupunks? He's my little grommet. He's coming up. He's, you know, he's fighting the good fight and doing his due diligence, and I'm on him a lot.
Talk about the tattoos on your body. I know there's a lot of them, so we're not going to go through each one of them, but how did you come to reach the distance?
I didn't want to be tattooed. I wanted to just do tattoos.
Really?
And there's this kind of mystique about that. I went through the whole, I think, trajectory that everybody who eventually gets tattooed goes through, and that was, it's the same thing as death, like fear, anger, denial, you know, and then acceptance.
But that's just so funny for somebody who creates tattoos for other people. To me, the obvious is that you would have your own tattoos.
Well, and that's honestly, that was a sticking point with my peers, because there's these skateboard guys and had a lot of freedom growing up from their parents, or just like, oh, you know, and maybe, you know, we do it with their groups of guys. So, you know, it was just their tribe. Being a young woman, I was raised to be a wife and make sure that I was appearing marriageable and available for, you know, whatever.
It was just not happening to you.
Well, it wasn't even in my mindset.
Right,
it wasn't even on my radar. I knew that, you know, all this hubris that I thought I could do good tattoos and superior tattoos even at the time, which, you know, still takes years. But it was just, I'm not enculturated to take a risk with my body like that. What? I got to keep my hair long. I got to keep my underwire bra.
And you better not gain weight.
Wax and pull all my hair out.
Yeah, got it.
So
what was your first tattoo?
Well, I ended up, my competitive bone came out. You know, the guys are like, was to be expected. Like, hey, what, you know, it's good enough for everybody else, not good enough for you. You know, why don't you? And so
get off your high horse.
Exactly. Get off my high horse. And so I went ahead and got something on my deltoid, which is, you know, the shoulder area, and which is quite bold. And I went through, because I'm this philosophy student and this young feminist, and I went through, and I'm going to get something super powerful and meaningful, which is, again, one of those trajectories we all go through. And so I was looking at all these rock carvings and from different cultures and finding, like, symbols that would resonate with me. So I show my boss this, like, weird, snaky leader dude carved into a rock. I'm like, this is what I want, after, like, you know, weeks and weeks of thinking. And he's like, that sucks. You're going to hate that. I'm not going to put that on you. And then, you know, I'm like, oh, horrible. Like, what do you want?
And so you took your ideas and went home.
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, the mentor, yeah, he smacked me down and I found something he still hated, but he did for me. And it was a Haida piece from the Haida tribe of Seattle, mm-hmm. of the Pacific Northwest, which is, the Pacific Northwest is a huge movement in tattooing. We didn't see so much of that in Florida, but from my travels as a kid, you know, I identified with that region. So he put it on there and it's still there to this day.
And that was the start of your body art.
And the start of my whole shift in my reality of who I am and what I came to the planet to do. And it's apparently not to, you know, be a, you know, support a man right now.
So who are your clients? Everybody? I mean, it's interesting. It's not just, you know, it's not just the sailor, and it's not the Hell's Angel. Obviously, he's not coming to Fifth Avenue anyway.
Sometimes they would, just because it's New York. So, like, and I was still, I'm 2 blocks away from where me and Spider had our 4,000 square foot squat on Broadway in Union, you know, where it was completely underground. So
right.
I'm 2 blocks away from that. So I'm still with the HA. You know, they run, I'm not with them, but they run our tattoo convention. And because I put my time in back in the day, I still get the cred with those guys. And we have our little, we give discounts to all the workers in the neighborhood. Because frankly, everybody's priced out. And honestly,
our tattoos a lot of money.
Tattoos are a luxury item. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're not a lot of money in the sense that maybe $40 minimum in the Bronx, you know, in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And then, like, we're $100 minimum on the scale, on that range, right? So, but it's a luxury in the sense that, boy, you better know what you're doing, even nowadays with your, you know, with your life path.
Yeah.
And so that's an emotional luxury in that sense. And
sure.
I myself didn't get anything that would show until I turned 35.
So how did you start from just the one tattoo on your deltoid to have it expand to basically your entire body? Is that fair to say?
No. I'm only tattooed where one can see it generally. So I consider this kind of like my armor. Again, my mom was a modelly, very manipulate men kind of personality with the beauty and the dazzling. So I would always, in a way to step away from that, I tattooed where it's visible, where I was kind of being an aggressive move.
But every tattoo has a meaning for you. Is there something deeper for you?
That's a little bit of a wormhole, because everybody, you know, I remember my non-tattoo dialogue will be like, well, when I get tattooed, it's going to be super meaningful. And I see these people and they just get whatever. And frankly, that's hubris right there. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't know.
That's also patronizing.
Yeah, completely. And all right. So there's little fun jobs I have on me, you know, and there's jobs I have because I love my friend and they put a dot on me or whatever. And so one of my peers at Inksmith and Rogers would say, when I would come to him all quaking as a 22-year-old, like, oh my gosh, I'm so afraid. I can't believe I'm doing this to myself and marking myself for life. He's like, it's not that serious. And I'm like, oh, you don't know. And then, like, now I say, okay, it's not that serious. Like, all it does is enhance my life.
Is it just second nature to you now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, easy.
I guess it would
22 years in now. Yeah, easily. Easily.
Well, Friday, we've run out of time. So let's continue the conversation next week. And in the meantime, why not visit Friday at fridayjones.net. I'm Sandy Klein.